This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 27, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, arguments challenging health care reform continue at the U.S. Supreme Court. Justices consider the legality of the individual mandate. Calls for justice in the shooting of unarmed teen Trayvon Martin intensify as questions emerge of the shooting death of another young man of color in Wisconsin. And we'll examine a program that aims to help some of the hundreds of Palestinian youth imprisoned by Israel each year. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The United Nations now says that at least 9,000 people have died during the last year of violence in Syria. Reports of violence and death continued today, despite an announcement by Joint UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has accepted a six-point proposal for peace. Last year, President Assad pledged to UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon that he would halt the violent repression against protesters, and he also agreed to an Arab League peace plan, but never implemented it. Syrian troops reportedly crossed the border into Lebanon today and fought with rebels taking refuge there. And Assad visited the Baba Amr area of Homs that's been a focal point in the fighting. According to the local coordinating committees, two of at least 20 dead across the country today were killed in Homs. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency proposed new rules that would strictly limit greenhouse gas emissions from new power plants. The rules cover all new coal-fired plants built more than 1 year after rule approval. The nationwide limits encourage capture and storage technologies to cut carbon dioxide output. EPA rules don't have to be approved by Congress, but Oklahoma Republican Senator Jim Inhofe is already threatening to block the new rules. Public comment will be taken for 60 days after the proposed rules are published in the Federal Register. Greenpeace says that while the move to limit carbon emissions by new plants is historic, they're disappointed that they don't cover biomass, they don't take effect immediately, and they give plants a 10-year grace period in exchange for a 30-year overall reduction. Greenpeace also takes issue with the use of carbon capture and storage, which the organization calls unproven technology. Officials in South Sudan say that Sudan's military bombed oil fields south of the border between the two countries early today. The airstrikes follow an air and ground incursion into South Sudan yesterday. Ground forces were later repelled by troops from the south. The United Nations says more than 16,000 people displaced by fighting in the Nuba Mountains are housed in a settlement near the disputed Lake Jow area. The UN's Melissa Fleming says talks with local elders are underway to convince the refugees to relocate to a more secure camp.
They prefer to stay and face the dangers and be close to their communities back home in the Nuba Mountains. They have agreed to relocate children, so we do have quite a number of children who are able to, we were able to relocate and also to place in schools.
UNHCR says they can't guarantee the safety of the refugees if they remain camped near a heavily militarized zone with recurrent fighting and bombing. In India today, 16 paramilitary troops died when their bus tripped a landmine. Dozens others were injured in the explosion attributed to masked rebels in the region. Jasvinder Sagal reports.
The blast coincided with the visit of the chief of India's largest paramilitary outfit, the Central Reserve Police Force. Officials say that the number of the dead and injured could increase owing to the high intensity of the blast. Today's attack is viewed as another attempt to build pressure on the Indian government to release several Maoist prisoners. The rebels are also holding two hostages in the Indian eastern state of Odisha. Maoists are active in six Indian states and claim to fight for poor and landless tribal people. They allege that the government extracts the area's precious mineral resources while not taking care of the local residents. The ruling party is seeking support for its move to set up a national counter-terrorism center. Jasvinder Sehgal, FSR in India.
Students at Norwich University are observing Gay Pride Week this week. Two things make that out of the ordinary. Most gay pride events are held in June or October. But even more interesting than the date of the event is the fact that Norwich is a military academy. The schedule for the week includes panel discussions as well as an open dance where same-sex couples are welcome. The ACLU filed a lawsuit today in a Georgia court on behalf of the widow of a man who died while in Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody. Roberto Medina Martinez died from inflammation of the heart caused by a virus. If accurately diagnosed, the condition is often treatable. The lawsuit claims that Medina Martinez was one of many ICE detainees who received inadequate health care at the Stewart Detention Center. The suit alleges wrongful death and seeks damages for Medina Martinez's widow. And Amnesty International is out with its annual look at executions around the globe. The U.S. is at number 5. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. It's the second day of Supreme Court hearings on the President's Affordable Care Act, and the 9 justices spent more than 2 hours debating what many consider the bill's central legal question. Does Congress have the power to compel nearly every person in the U.S. to obtain health insurance? FSRN's Alice Olstein heard this morning's arguments and files this report.
All those who argued before the nation's high court Tuesday morning agreed that the U.S. healthcare system is badly in need of reform. But Paul Clement, the attorney for the states challenging the Affordable Care Act, says Congress overstepped its power by mandating that millions of uninsured Americans either purchase insurance or pay a penalty.
The Commerce Clause gives Congress the power to regulate existing commerce. It does not give Congress the far greater power to compel people to enter commerce, to create commerce essentially in the first place.
Some people are exempt from the mandate, including prisoners, undocumented immigrants, religious workers, and people who make so little income they don't file tax returns. But Clement called the young, healthy people who will have to buy insurance golden geese and said they'll be forced to subsidize care for others. He also said the government does not have the power to regulate someone not doing something. But Justice Elena Kagan argued that refusing to buy insurance is an act, one that has consequences for the whole population.
If the effect of all these uninsured people is to raise everybody's premiums, not just when they get sick, if they get sick, but right now, and the aggregate of all these uninsured people are increasing the normal family premium, Congress says, by $1,000 a year. Those people are in commerce. They're making decisions that are affecting the price that everybody pays for this service.
Both attorneys arguing against the Affordable Care Act said this problem can be solved by forcing people to buy insurance when they need health care, but not before. But the Justice Department's Don Verrilli, who argued on behalf of the federal government, says this would lead to disaster.
When people have that guarantee that they can get insurance, they're going to make that calculation that they won't get it until they're sick and they need it. And so the pool of people in the insurance market gets smaller and smaller. The rates you have to charge to cover them get higher and higher. It helps if fewer insurance covers fewer and fewer people until the system ends.
The Department of Health and Human Services estimated in 2008 that uninsured Americans pay for only 37% of their health care costs. The rest gets paid for through higher premiums for those who do buy insurance. Burley argued that using the individual mandate to address this problem is legal under the Necessary and Proper Clause of the Constitution, which empowers Congress to make any laws within its power to achieve a necessary and proper goal. But Michael Carvin, who argued against the mandate on behalf of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, says giving Congress a pass on this particular choice is dangerous.
And again, if Congress has the power to compel you to buy this product, then obviously they've got the power to compel you to buy any product, because any purchase is going to benefit commerce, and this court is never going to second guess Congress's policy judgments on how important it is.
Outside the courtroom, other heated debates were taking place. Union members, doctors, and advocates for Planned Parenthood and the National Organization for Women argued with Tea Party protesters and fundamentalist Christian groups. The Koch brothers' political group, Americans for Prosperity, and other conservative organizations also demonstrated Tuesday against the health care law.
I'd like the government to get out of it so it can get back to being cheap again.
That's Susan Clark, a self-identified Tea Party activist from Santa Monica, California. Wearing a tricorner hat with feathers and a fringed leather vest, she explained why she believes the government shouldn't be allowed to regulate the private healthcare market.
They make things more expensive, and they use the taxpayer as an ATM machine.
Just feet away, a large group, including reproductive health and women's rights advocates, rallied in defense of the president's reform bill. Maria Elena Perez from New York City says the Affordable Care Act will also address the disparities that affect the Latino community.
Everyone should have a right to health care, and Latinos especially benefit from this ACA law. With Latinos, we know that they have a higher incidence of diabetes, and we're talking about women like cervical cancer, also asthma, unplanned pregnancy. So these are kind of the things that the health disparities that exist in our communities. And by supporting this law, we know that more people will be covered.
The American Constitution Society and other legal groups have written about the centrality of the individual mandate to the rest of the Affordable Care Act reforms, including expanding Medicaid and ending discrimination for pre-existing conditions. They argue that if the court finds the mandate unconstitutional, the rest could go with it. This prospect worries Perez and motivated her to demonstrate outside the court.
It's scary to think about the law being taken away from us because of the benefits that it does have for Latinos. But, you know, we're going to continue fighting our voices, continue lifting our voices because we want to be heard.
On Wednesday, the last day of arguments on the Affordable Care Act, the court will consider whether the rest of the law can still stand if the individual mandate is struck down. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Across the country, demonstrations and vigils continue following the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, the unarmed teen visiting his family in Florida. One growing form of protest is wearing hoodies, the article of clothing Martin was wearing when he was killed. Others continue to circulate petitions calling for a thorough investigation into Martin's death. Yesterday was the one-month anniversary of the shooting in Sanford, Florida, in which George Zimmerman, a self-appointed neighborhood watch volunteer, shot and killed Martin. In Detroit, NAACP President Dr. Wendell Anthony addressed the crowd.
Together with young people, old people, brown people, red people, all people, we have come together today to say that no justice, no justice, no justice. God bless.
In Pittsburgh, Brittany Claude, student at Carnegie Mellon University, spoke at a rally sponsored by the Black Graduate Student Association. Claude connected the killing of Trayvon Martin to other incidents across the country.
We fight not only for black people, but for all people victimized by hate and the even more pernicious and deadly force of apathy. We mourn their deaths and also the very recent slayings of Rekia Boyd in Chicago and Shaima Alawadi in California. But we also stand firm in our conviction to fight racism, to fight hate, and to be honest with ourselves and others of the progress this country must still make.
In Florida, Reverend Jesse Jackson joined Martin's parents, other civil rights leaders, and Congress members in the call for the repeal of the state's Stand Your Ground law, which police have cited as a reason for not arresting the shooter, George Zimmerman.
Mr. Zimmerman should be arrested. The law should be, the law of Stand Your Ground should be repealed, just as the voter ID law should be repealed for the same forces finance both of them. In a real sense, the blood of this martyr has illuminated the darkness, and we shall maintain our vigilance and our action until justice is done.
Sound provided by the Orlando Sentinel website. The Sentinel also said it obtained a copy of a police report based on Zimmerman's account of the incident. According to the Sentinel, Zimmerman told police that Martin punched him and slammed his head into the pavement. Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, said, quote, "They killed my son, and now they're trying to kill his reputation." Fulton and her husband are in Washington, D.C., where they're meeting with members of the House Judiciary Committee. Rallies have also been growing in a separate case in Wisconsin. On March 3rd, Bo Morrison, a biracial 20-year-old, was shot and killed in the village of Slinger, Wisconsin. The killing has brought into question the state's gun rights law adopted last year, called the Castle Doctrine Law, which allows homeowners facing imminent danger to use deadly force. Some are also calling on police to release the full audio of the 911 call from early that morning. According to Politiscope, the previous tapes had been edited, and police now confirm that the shooter, Adam Kind, is heard calling Morrison an expletive on the tape before he shoots him. For more, we're joined by Bruce Vilmedi. He's a journalist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has been covering the case. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks.
First, describe what's known about the circumstances on the night of March 3rd that led to the shooting of 20-year-old Bo Morrison.
Well, we happen to know more than we did for several weeks because the district attorney in the county where this occurred put out a report last week that included a lot more of the facts. They basically are a bunch of young people, some under 21, a few over, were having a party in a garage in a town called Slinger, Wisconsin. And they were, I guess, being kind of noisy. And about 1 in the morning, a gentleman who lives next door to the party went outside. And in addition to people in the garage, there were, I guess, some in a car, and the car was had loud music playing. The homeowner asked him to turn it down. He may have had some words with some people in the car and then went back to his house and called police to report the party. And that's at 1 o'clock. Some local police officers, two cars show up at the garage, but by then all the kids have gone inside. They don't come to the door. The police spend about 40 minutes there trying to get them out, and they're in contact with some of the mother of the house where the party's being taking place. She's not home, but the police know her and call her at work, and she's apparently trying to raise her kids in the garage to come out, but they won't. Eventually, the police decide to just leave the scene and issue tickets to people in the morning. So they withdraw from the area. They pull away to two different parking places, both within sight of this garage, not that far away, a few hundred feet. And one of the police officers calls the original, the next-door neighbor, Adam Kind, who complained about the party and explains, you know, here's what we've done, here's what we're going to do. And at about the same time, they talk for 4.5 minutes. And then he calls the mother back, mother of some of the kids hosting this party, and she says, oh, I've now been able to raise my husband, who's asleep in the house next door to the party, the house where the garage is, and the police tell him, okay, great, but have him meet us in the driveway. Somehow or another, he goes into the garage ahead of the police, tells them that, you know, get out of my garage. Some of the kids, including Bo Morrison, leave the party, and within a couple of minutes, he's shot in the neighbor's back porch.
So, to be clear, Bo Morrison, he was on the property of that neighbor, is that right?
Oh, yeah, it's very clear. He was clearly inside this guy's house. We call it a porch, but it's an enclosed porch. It had insulation. There was a refrigerator and a dresser and some other things out there, but it was small. It's about 7 by 11 feet. And he had ducked into this room on this neighbor's house to hide from the police.
And we should also point out, he was unarmed.
He was unarmed. According to the report that came out, he was hiding, kind of crouched down on this porch between a refrigerator and a dresser in a small space, I guess, which, you know, maybe even if someone had ducked in there and looked real quick, they might not have seen him if he was crunched down between these two other items.
Some friends and family of Bo Morrison have asked why other options, actions weren't taken during that encounter. Is there anything in the report that talks about other options besides firing the gun at him?
No, it doesn't really. I mean, that's clearly just that. And after the fact, lots of people ask, you know, why did he do this? And I'm sure the homeowner himself now wonders why he did it. But the report doesn't really address that. The report just examines what he did do and applies the law that the DA decided that, you know, it was justifiable in self-defense and under the state's relatively new Castle Doctrine.
Well, you've referred to this investigation by the Washington County District Attorney, and as you said, it looked into the events of that night and concluded that it would not file any charges against the shooter, Adam Kind, on that evening. Talk about the Castle Doctrine and how it influences that and how that's become a center of this.
Well, I said the district attorney made a point in his analysis of first stating that even without the Castle Doctrine, he would not have charged this guy. But the fact that it is the first case since the adoption of the Castle Doctrine here in Wisconsin of a homeowner shooting an intruder, that sort of became a big part of the story. just because it had a lot of discussion when it was passed. Most prosecutors and law enforcement said it was unnecessary, and it is sort of associated with other gun rights agenda laws like concealed carry or stand your ground and that kind of thing. And so the fact that it did apply, and it would have applied had he been charged, he'd have been able to rely on that presumption and made the prosecutor's case a little harder, I think brought it a little more attention than it might have gotten. And it maybe is giving it a little longer attention than it would have gotten otherwise, maybe 2 years ago if the same thing had happened.
And when was that law adopted into law in Wisconsin?
Last year. I think it took effect in December, I think.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Vilmedi is a journalist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the case of 20-year-old Bo Morrison, who was shot and killed in the village of Slinger, Wisconsin on March 3rd. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
In Seoul, South Korea, nations are wrapping up a meeting on nuclear safety by focusing on securing nuclear material. Attendants cite concerns of it falling into the hands of terrorist groups. But as FSRN's Jason Strother reports, despite an agreement to reduce highly enriched uranium, some question if the summit is really making the world safer from a nuclear attack.
Much of the nuclear waste that lies in stockpiles around the world is composed of highly enriched uranium. U.S. government officials and many other nations fear that if this material falls into the wrong hands, it could result in the creation of a dirty bomb. On Tuesday, the U.S., France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and South Korea signed deals to convert around 200 European medical research reactors from highly enriched to low-enriched uranium. Low-enriched uranium can only be used in energy production. South Korean President Lee Myung-bak pointed to the deal as one of the summit's top accomplishments as he read the joint communique at the close of the forum. Lee says when these nations finalized the conversion in 2015, the need for highly enriched uranium will be greatly reduced. And that means there will be less material that could be proliferated. But some analysts say that while the agreement is a welcome development, it's really just a drop in the bucket. That's according to Miles Pomper, senior researcher at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He says the summit is missing a framework that measures how much material is actually secured.
There was never any agreed upon definition of secure. What does it mean to secure materials? There's no legal standard internationally that's binding it. How do you say if you've accomplished the goal or not if you don't have any standards?
Pomper suggests one way to resolve the problem is to create a peer monitoring system to make sure nations are following through with their pledges. But he doubts that by the time the next summit is held in 2014, the goal of securing all nuclear material will be reached. Jason Strother, FSRN, Seoul.
Israel arrests and detains approximately 700 Palestinian children annually. This reality has forced Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem to develop programs to address the trauma these children exhibit when released from prison. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Damore has more from Beit Sahor.
Hamza was 16 when Israeli soldiers came to his home in the middle of the night and arrested him. Suspected of throwing stones at Israeli settlers near his school in the West Bank, he says he was blindfolded, handcuffed, and beaten on the way to interrogation.
When they took me to the prison, they put me in a small cell. They used to throw the food through the space between the door and the floor. We had our meals in the same place where we peed. Sometimes they stripped us. They stripped us and mocked us and beat us at the same time.
Hamza, who preferred to give his first name only, spent 5 months in Israel's Ofer military prison. 3 months after his release, he began counseling sessions at the YMCA in Beit Sahur to deal with the trauma he experienced there.
At the beginning, I was very desperate. I didn't talk to anyone. I didn't want to go outside the house. I was very nervous. I'd be irritated with the simplest matters. But now, after the counseling sessions, I feel relieved. I felt myself getting better, even better than before the prison.
Israel is a signatory to the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, which defines a child as anyone under the age of 18. The convention states that countries should only arrest and detain children as a measure of last resort and for the shortest appropriate period of time. Still, a recent report released by Save the Children and the East Jerusalem YMCA Rehabilitation Program estimates that since 2000, Israel has arrested and detained more than 8,000 Palestinian children. This includes children as young as 12 years old. The report found that 98% of Palestinian children were subjected to physical or psychological violence during their arrest and detention, and that 90% suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and experienced nightmares, bedwetting, anxiety, and other signs of trauma. Nader Abu Amsha is director of the East Jerusalem YMCA Rehabilitation Program. He says the program's major aim is to give ex-detainee children the daily skills they need to cope with their trauma.
It's a continuous traumatic experience people are living under. That's why we are trying our best to help, not just in therapy, but in building the coping mechanism and helping people maintain their resilience ability. Trauma might happen in normal settings, it might happen once in life. But here, when it comes to having daily hard experiences, like checkpoints, like soldiers around, like settlers attacking people, like everything surrounding you might be kind of a trigger for a traumatic event you went through.
Sometimes children are detained merely on the suspicion of throwing stones. That was the case for Fuad, who was 17 when Israeli soldiers arrested him near his Bethlehem area home. He spent 8 months in prison before being released.
I went to school after that, but they refused to take me back. I was in trouble with my parents and my friends all the time. My spirits were down, crushed. I had frequent thoughts about the prison. I was very scared.
After counseling sessions and passing a work training program, Fuath is now working in the field of car electronics and says he isn't afraid of Israeli soldiers anymore.
I used to think of my parents, of my opportunities outside the prison, about the job I will get. But when I was released, I didn't find a job. I sat jobless at home. But now I have fewer problems. My psychological hardships and the negative thoughts are gone now.
The Adamir Prisoner Support Organization estimates that more than 160 Palestinian children were being held in Israeli prisons as of February 1st of this year. All Palestinian children in the West Bank are subject to Israel's military court system, which had a nearly 100% conviction rate in 2010. Jillian Kessler-Damour, FSRN, Beit Sahur.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Cobb. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marino.